Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me today is Spencer Seams from the High and Low podcast, where you talk your way through Kira Kurosawa's filmography, plus some other films, right?
We take a Kurosawa movie and we compare it to another Japanese movie from the same year.
But today we're not talking about Kurosawa or any Japanese film.
Nope.
We're going to be talking about a film called The Rat, which I guess English translation would be Dry Season.
Uh-huh.
And it's from Chad. And it's directed by Mohamed Saleh Haroun. How does that sound?
That sounds better than I could ever say it.
So maybe we should start by kind of summarizing the film. I can start and you can just interject when I start mm-hmm. messing up, but
it's pretty straightforward for the most part.
It's a pretty straightforward story. Like one thing that kind of surprised me is it feels a little bit like loose and slow, but you kind of realized, especially towards the end, just how carefully structured it all is.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it's like a very traditional story in some regards, or there's at least like traditional elements in it, yeah. I think could be pointed out.
Yeah, it feels kind of like, I think on DVD it calls it a parable, and it definitely does kind of feel like a parable or like a folktale in certain
yes.
ways.
Yeah. I think maybe at some point during this episode I should make my case for how it's kind of like a low-key remake of the Star Wars trilogy. But
yeah, I saw on Twitter the picture comparisons, which at first I thought this is a little much. Then I saw them like, oh, there is something there.
Well, it's about a sort of country boy in the desert, Atim, who's an orphan, and his blind grandfather gives him a pistol. He says, this belonged to your father. There's sort of an implied filial obligation that he's supposed to go and kill the man who killed his father, because
yeah.
there's a presidential decree on the radio that there's going to be an amnesty to end the hostilities and tensions of the Civil War, and there's this reaction like, oh, how can this happen? Like, there's not going to be any justice.
Yeah.
You need to go and kill this guy who killed your father.
And so, like, all the war criminals who got away with horrible things get mm-hmm. zero punishment, basically.
Right.
Including the man who killed Atim's father before he was born.
Right. So Atim sets out to kill this man who we find out is maybe not quite what he expects. His name's Nasaha, and he's a baker. Boulangerie.
Yeah.
Nasaha, I think it's called the name of his bakery. And
yeah, it's in the capital city of Chad, too, which is very, very purposeful. It's set in the capital.
Yes. It's definitely like a different environment than what a team is coming from. Like, there's soldiers around who kind of beat him up without any repercussions.
Yeah.
You know, when he first shows up, he's taking a piss on the wall, and, you know, two soldiers just decide to basically beat him up
yeah.
out of boredom, I guess. That's
and they are
just because they can.
And they are sitting right next to a flag of Chad tied
yeah.
to a branch, which this time is like, oh, okay, I get what's going on here.
Right. And he's saved kind of by this guy called Musa, who's friendly, but he's also like a little bit of a scoundrel.
Yeah, he's like a small-time thief, basically.
Yeah, he's like, I forget, was he taking the siding off of houses?
The siding, and he was taking
it?
The light bulbs around town and selling them.
Yeah, just sort of stealing whatever he can and selling it. And Atim helps him out, but he doesn't really want the dirty money. He's just, like, at a certain point, kind of distances himself from Musa. And, like, Musa, the way he kind of makes up little lies, like, when he introduces Atim to, was it his aunt
yeah.
at the house?
Well, he says
you know,
his aunt.
He's like, oh, yeah, this is my friend from America. She's like, if he's from America, I'm from Mars.
Yeah. But although that could, like, be his sister or his mom. Like, you really don't know, because he's proven to be a liar.
He's not a reliable person, yeah. He sort of lies about little things. So Atim, he's following around Nasaha, who's the baker who killed his father, and he sees him like handing out, I guess, the like expired baguettes he
yeah.
gives to the I don't know if they're orphans necessarily, but the kids who can't, who have nothing to eat, you know, he's handing out sort of the expired food, giving it away. And when Atim first looks him face to face, he gives him one of these baguettes and he takes a bite out of it and he spits it out very defiantly, you know. And
Yeah, well, a team we need to point out, he's supposed to be 15 or 16.
yeah, he's a teenager, and he's still sort of not naive, but like he has a very set idea of how the way the world works that's challenged as the film goes on. Because like Nasara, the first thing he does after he spits out the bread is offer a team a job, basically. He's like, well, like I can see you're not here for charity, you know, if you come tomorrow I'll give you work. So a team actually ends up working at the bakery for the man who killed his father, and Nasara doesn't know who he is yet. He just thinks he's this teenage boy who showed up, basically. And I should point out too, like you realize that Nasara has his own injuries, you know, like he has I guess it's an electrolarynx, you know, you see people sometimes use when they have throat cancer, but he uses it because he had his throat cut out. And
Someone tried, it's mentioned very casually, his wife says, oh, he is sleeping, someone tried to slit his throat.
Well, you even wonder, like, could it have been Atim's father? Like, you don't know quite what the story is behind that,
I
you know,
never even
because,
thought it could have been his father.
like, a lot of it's kind of left in the background, and you sort of have to work out exactly, you know, maybe there's a connection there, or maybe not.
I took
You
that,
know, so much goes unsaid, yeah.
I took that more as there's just probably just a random stranger during the Civil War attacked him, not necessarily his father.
Well, like if it was during his sleep, like it could have been just, you know, somebody else, like a team who wanted revenge, because it kind of implies that he's done some pretty awful things. And like one thing I like actually about the film is I think in some ways dramatically it would have been lazier to portray Nasara as this like kindly man who's like super generous. And you know, while he definitely has that side to him, he can be, you know, kind of a bastard too. He's not always friendly, and like sometimes he's actually quite scary.
The actor's name is Yusuf Jaro.
Jiao, I guess.
What you said, I'm not sure how to say that. But
Yusuf Jiao, I think he was maybe also in another one of Mohamed Saleh Haroun's films.
I've seen four of his films, and he's in the four I've seen.
Okay, he's in all of them.
I think he might be in all his narrative films, because Haroon
Because he also
also,
did Bye Bye Africa. Yeah.
he, and he does some documentaries here and there. Like, he does like a movie in Chad, and then he'll do a movie in France. He just alternates
Okay.
between his two homes.
This is my first film I've seen of
Oh,
his, so
okay.
I'm still new to his filmography. I kind of knew about Bye Bye Africa just through reputation, and I think what might have put it on my radar is just, you know, sometimes when you buy the DVDs, there's like a little leaflet showing like what else is in our catalog. I think like maybe that's the first place I saw it, so I had sort of a vague idea of it being out there. But thank you for getting me to watch it, because it's fantastic, I think. And
For me, this is like I would recommend this movie to pretty much anyone. To me, this movie is basically perfect. Like, I just love everything about it. And I first saw it 2.5 years ago, and I'm always thinking about it, like, at least once a day.
I can see why. I mean, I just saw it for the first time like 2 weeks ago, but it's definitely left like a strong impression, and I feel like there's a lot to unpack for what's such an elegantly constructed film. Like it seems simple, but it also seems like there's so much you can dive into and peel apart and try to understand, you know, and has this very strong emotional core. Because I mean, we're sort of working our way through the plot, but like people are probably, you know, if they haven't seen it, they might realize that like Atim becomes a sort of surrogate son for Nasara at a certain point. You know, he's introduced also to his wife, Aisha, who's quite a bit younger. Like she's closer to Atim's age. She's maybe like mid 20s. you know, in the Sahara's, you know, maybe like mid 40s. You know, she sort of explains that it was an arranged marriage, so you know, her parents set it up, but you can tell there's like a little bit of distance in that marriage.
Yeah.
You know, we were mentioning also like how Nasara isn't always nice. Like there's a scene where she's speaking with a team, just kind of hanging out, and he comes home and catches her just like talking to him.
Oh, and she's she not wearing
her, yeah, her head's not covered. Yeah. So like, you know, and then in the next scene, you can hear in the background him beating her, you know, which like he's that kind of a guy.
It's also, I think, just cultural too.
Sure. I think that's sort of expected, but like he's, you know, comes across very traditional, kind of callous. He's sort of an intimidating person, and it kind of keeps you on your toes if a team is empathizing with him, or if he can work his way up to actually shooting him. You know, there's a few points when he actually has a gun just pointed right at him when he's not looking, and he just can't quite find it in himself to pull that trigger. And one of the subplots in the film is that Aisha, she's pregnant. And like, you actually get a sense of how much time the story takes place, because at the beginning, she's like barely pregnant. Mm-hmm. There's a certain point where you kind of notice that she's very pregnant, and then she has a miscarriage. And Nasara feels like, you know, God's abandoned him. Allah's abandoned him. You know, he's very hurt, and he sort of feels like nobody in the town likes him. Everybody kind of hates him. And, he, you know, the only person in his life that he has sort of a meaningful relationship with, aside from his wife, is Atim. You know, so he wants Atim to be like his son, and even offers to adopt him towards the end of the film. You know, there's a scene where he just tells a stranger or an acquaintance going by, it's a stranger to Atim, but like somebody Nasara would have known, and they ask like, oh, who's that? And he said, oh, this is my son, sort of casually, and that of course upsets Atim, you know. Yells at
but
him.
Like Atim is kind of alternates between being like kind of like friendly and just being like kind of a brooding like teen boy, but like in this
it's a pretty believable performance as like a teenage boy. I find like that's
but he had, you know, he also has a good reason to be brooding too.
Yeah, he has a good reason to be brooding. And there's this sort of, like, insinuation that he could easily end up being, like, these government thugs, you know, soldier thugs that you see throughout the film. Like, you know, when he's riding the bus on the way to town, the guy just pulls a gun on him, sort of casually, just to intimidate him because he's looking at him the wrong way. And then towards the end of the film, like, there's a shot that's identical with the team pointing the gun directly at the camera, and you sort of get the feeling that, like, oh, he could end up being just like that guy. And then you know, Atim got beat up when he's taking a piss, and then later on when he sees a soldier, the same soldier, taking a piss on the wall at night after he's drunk, he goes and beats him up. So, you know, there's little parallels that that cycle of violence could easily continue. He could fall into that. And
also during, after he beats up the soldier from earlier, there's another soldier who he bumps a cigarette off of him, and then you see a team that's pull out the gun and he fires, and you don't know if he hit or killed a soldier, or
because later on there's a soldier who asks him for a cigarette with no leg, right?
That's when you see him fire towards a soldier, and you don't see the aftermath of whether or not the soldier was hit or what. So it's just kind of left ambiguous of, did he kill someone?
You know, and I feel like that ambiguity is sort of meaningful, because like Atim himself doesn't know, and you know, you sort of have to understand like where you fit into that cycle of violence, and you know, maybe your own culpability in it. Like I think a big part of the film is trying to find a way to break that. Like, you know, the big climax of the film is Atim returning home to his grandfather and Nasara following him, and the grandfather has Atim pull his gun on Nasara and tells him to, you know, take off his clothes and shoot him. And I was really worried the film might not have a good ending or a happy ending. You know, and it doesn't exactly, like, I wouldn't call it a happy ending necessarily in the way you might think of for like a Hollywood film, but a team when he's torn between, you know, does he fulfill that obligation to revenge, or, you know, does he side with his sort of new father, Nasaha? You know, ultimately, what he does is pretend to shoot him. He shoots the gun up into the air, and the blind grandfather thinks that he killed him, and he takes the grandfather away. And, you know, it's sort of, in some ways, bittersweet that he saved this man's life that he could have killed, but also that, you know, there's not going to be this family made. You know, it's sort of an ambivalent note emotionally that the film ends on.
Like, I see it as he's compromising between the two father figures in his life.
Yes.
But, like, you don't know, like, how close he is to his grandfather exactly. You just know he just is, I guess, obedient to his grandfather because that's kind of the only real authority he's ever had in his life, where he actually becomes emotionally close to Nasara, and Nasara's like the basically becomes the father that he never had. So like, I think maybe later on, this is extra textual, so like, some people think that's bullshit, but I don't care. But like, if you would cut to a few years later, he'd realize that he's probably not that close to his own grandfather, because you never get a real sense of him having an emotional connection to his grandfather, besides just the fact that he's family, and that's it. And, like, Nasara was actually, like, a caring figure in his life, where, like, and presumably his mother was killed during Civil War, too. It's never really brought up what happened to his mother.
Right. It's not explained exactly, but you can sort of guess, you know. I mean, there's no one else in his life. But Civil War leaves a lot of orphans. That's the case. Have you seen the Claire Denis film White Material?
No.
Okay, because the actor who plays Atin, Ali Barkai, he plays a character in that film. I almost thought, like, it's hard not to kind of superimpose that character a little bit on what a team's future might be. But for people who've seen it, it's sort of maybe interesting to watch these two films next to each other. You know, it's obviously not a sequel, but that's kind of maybe one possibility of how this character might end up. I think White Material, it's set in Cameroon, so it's not but French, former French.
That's a lot. That's a lot of Africa.
A lot of Africa. Like, I don't. I watched Timbuktu last night. Just to, like, you know, two completely different countries and culture and everything. But like, it's kind of, you know, on one hand you can sort of see some similarities, but you know, between Chadian story and the Mali stories. I was wondering, what do you think of Dahrat visually? Like, it's really interesting that not just the cinematography, but a lot of the visual choices, maybe the way shots mirror each other. There's a lot of mirror imagery I found throughout the film.
Oh yeah, you brought up him pointing the gun, pointing a gun similar to a soldier from earlier, and the scenes of getting beaten and beating the soldier near each other. And then one I didn't pick up till this time was I think it's when he doesn't put the yeast in the bread, and Nasara,
he's pissed.
He spits out a piece of bread team did the first time they met.
He forces him to like hand it out to the kids, or maybe not forces him, but like he's handing it out, like this bread they can't sell, obviously, because it's just like hard as a rock. And the kids, instead of taking it and eating it, it's so awful, they just like throw it back at a team. So like, again, there's like a little reversal in there. There's a few other, like there's the shot of a team sort of rehearsing him shooting Nasara, like he's getting himself psyched up, and he's pointing the gun at the mirror, but it's also like he's pointing the gun at himself. And then like a few scenes later, there's Nasara also looking in the mirror, and he's feeling his scar. So you can make a connection between those characters and how like, you know, to some degree, Nesaha might be a team's future.
Yeah.
Like, there's something a little bit cyclical in that relationship between, you know, this guy who had a violent youth and a youth who's about to enter a world of violence. So
yeah, and like maybe like Nasrallah literally sees him as a young version of himself and wants to like correct the mistakes of his past.
Yes, I think so. Have you seen the film Spring, Summer, Fall, Winter, and Spring by Kim Ki-duk?
Nope.
Oh, like it's sort of a relationship between like a old monk and a young mm-hmm. monk, and trying to maybe correct a violent past. And towards the end of the film, it kind of takes it into a sort of allegorical territory mm-hmm. further by having the story repeat itself in a chronological sense. That, you know, the young monk makes his mistakes mm-hmm. and tries to correct for them, and ultimately becomes the old monk, you know, trying to correct the mistakes of the new young monk, and like it becomes sort of a cycle. And I thought a bit about that mm-hmm. watching this, how you can maybe see the future for one character and the other, and the past for the other and the other character. You know, if a team kind of goes down that path, you sort of think maybe someday he'll have some orphaned kid showing up to kill him, you know.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, big question in the film is how to move on past that civil conflict. You know, because in some ways, like it's sort of a correct response at the beginning when they hear that, like, the guy who killed his father is not going to have any punishment. Like, what do you mean amnesty? How can there be justice?
Yeah.
So, like, it's that contradiction of, like, how do you stop this endless bloodshed when it involves sort of a rejection of justice? You know, I think the film shows that contradiction throughout. And ultimately, like, I think, you know, comes to a conclusion that's not one or the other, it's both. So.
Yeah, it's like the end is a compromise between, like, the two, like, opposing methods. It should be talked, mm-hmm. should be brought up, but the movie is very, very quiet. Like, there is no music until the end credits. And that just really grounds you, and it's, like, really, like, like that can do one, two things in a movie. It could be distracting and pointing out flaws, or it can like really engross you into it. And this, unless like it just makes you feel like with like an Ozu movie, you're just watching a slice of real life.
Right. I mean, it also keeps you feeling tense too, because you know that long periods of quiet. Mm-hmm. I almost felt like at any moment there could have been something very violent, just like break loose. And you know, there's a few points of violence, but like, the gunshots in the movie are so loud that it really just slices through that slice of life quietness. It's like when you pop a balloon, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, like, well, in the opening, when Tim and his grandfather are listening to a radio, you get after the results are said, you hear this machine gun fire mm-hmm. from the village, and you don't really know where. And they just act like it's nothing, like that's just everyday life to them.
Right. And well, and then like the image of all those shoes that a team walks through, like, you know, there's sort of an eerie image, these shoes without owners. There's things you could, like, you don't know for sure, but you can kind of guess.
And like, there's no blood or anything. Yeah. So it's kind of like, did they run away? Were they all killed and captured? It's just, you know, it's left, like, the way violence is handled in this is very, it's like, very unpleasant. You never see violence directly, but it's always incredibly realistic and unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. And the emotional violence you can kind of still pick up on, you know, like, there's that bit where Atim's on his cell phone
mm-hmm.
and Nasaha catches him and he throws the phone, and like he goes just like a little bit too far, you know, he's upset, but he gets like a little bit too upset.
Yeah.
And, you know, the next scene, he's just trying to make up for it. He like offers him money even, and Atim doesn't take it. And he says, you know, I'm sorry. Sometimes I can't control myself. Sometimes I can even be dangerous. I've done a lot of harm in my life. You know, like he's somebody who that potential for violence is definitely there, and he can be still emotionally hurtful, even though he's trying to heal. You know, he's trying to make an effort.
Yeah.
I was wondering, there's one part in the film where a team, the gun that he brought mm-hmm. with him, his father's gun, that goes missing. What do you think happened to it?
I would think probably Nasrallah probably took it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really think of anything else, because right. like no one else can really get into his home, and I'm sure no one would want to break into his home, because I feel like the locals are fully aware of who he is.
So do you think, I mean, I think that's the case too, but I was wondering if that means that for a sizable chunk of the movie, Nasrallah knows that a team is probably there to kill him. You know, he might not mm-hmm. know why exactly, but I think he knows. Yeah. There's one part when like when he's giving Nasrallah like a back massage because mm-hmm. he pulled out his back and like he needs a harness later in the film, back harness. You know, he's like almost ready to strangle him, and Nasrallah doesn't seem that surprised. He sort of knows yeah. to keep on his toes. Like sometimes the kind of like looks he gives a team, you know, it's like I know what you're up to. But like yeah. I think he sort of understands too, he has to work with him, and maybe the only way to solve this is to show him love. Like he talks about when they're making the bread, like the only way to make the bread good is to show it love and care. And I think he's trying to sort of make the yeast in a team rise, so yeah. to speak.
And where are we going with that? Like the use of bread makes it feel like almost like biblical, or like a folktale, like I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that's maybe it could be simple of something, but I never took any film classes or film theory, so I'm not sure like what.
I mean, like bread... there's like breaking the bread is sort of mm-hmm. maybe an obvious connection. Visually, the film, I feel like the movie, a lot of it's like bread colored, like
yeah.
all those like earthy yellow tones. And then it'll be like punctuated with like really strong blue, like the oh, door yeah. to the bakery is blue. And then Nasrallah, when he first sees him, he's just in that blue robe. And then later on, Atim, when he's waiting for him to show up the day after, like he's dressed in blue next to that door. So,
yeah,
you know, and the all, kind of natural contrast of those images. Yeah.
And Atim wears a lot of blue jeans too.
Yeah.
I noticed, like, I feel like Atim wears more blue as the movie goes on, as he's warming up to Nasrallah.
And there's, like, the scene where Nasrallah is feeling his scar and kind of reliving his past. He's wearing black. And then at the very end, Atim is wearing black when he's ready to maybe shoot him.
Yeah. Like,
I don't know if there's maybe a deliberate connection there, but it feels the way that the color is used throughout the film pretty purposeful.
Oh yeah, that definitely yeah. felt like it's, I don't know if there's a Grim Reaper in Islam, but like it definitely felt like an angel of death type symbol, with like
right.
him wearing black at the end where he's taking him to his grandfather.
Or if I wanted to go back to my Star Wars mm-hmm. connection, it's like Luke, who's wearing all white at the beginning, and then by Return of the Jedi, he's dressed in all black, and you know, is put in the position of killing his father, and like the grandfather when he's like execute him, you know, maybe think of like the Emperor in Star Wars being like finish him, and you know, but mm-hmm. he chooses not to kill his father figure, you know, ultimately mm-hmm. he turns away from that violence. So
yeah.
the climax, like, but I mean, you know, I'm being a little bit glib with my comparison, mm-hmm. but I think there is, like you said, that sort of folktale route, the parable route, and mm-hmm. like Star Wars, of course, so much of that's built on that
Joseph Campbell,
yeah. the monomyth, you know, and it feels like there's some kind of commonality in the folklore. Mm-hmm. The
I didn't see any hidden fortress in this though.
maybe no hidden fortress, but a lot of it looks like Tatooine.
Yeah, that is true too.
And like even the fact that Nasaha, he's this tall, kind of imposing guy, he's like Darth Vader, you know, when he talks through the electrolarynx, you know, it's like Darth Vader speaking. And he dresses like, you know, we said that once, you know, all black, and he's like has his scars, and he almost gets like more beat up throughout the film. Like he gets his finger caught on the bread machine and his back hurt. Like you sort of feel like he's falling apart a little bit towards the end.
I love his performance so much. It's just like he barely speaks, but his looks are just so powerful. Like I can't think of many actors who can act like this through their eyes the way he does.
Right. I mean, like a lot of it, it makes sense within the film because he can barely speak.
Later on, like it comes into play, like his faith in Allah is fading, and in the next, I think it might be next Harun movie, A Screaming Man, it stars Yusuf, and he plays a grieving father, not grieving father, but he plays a father who is losing his faith in Allah again. But
that's interesting. So is it sort of like a thematic sequel, or and does it build on certain things in this film?
Yeah, it builds on certain things, but A Screaming Man is it's same approach. Like it's a very stripped down, simple story, but there's a lot of like thematic stuff to unpack about contemporary Chad and its politics. But like in A Screaming Man, he's not intimidating or scary. He plays kind of like this middle-aged dad who wants to keep his job as a pool cleaner at a hotel, basically. Huh. And it's crazy seeing him on this, and you watch A Screaming Man, it's like, oh, he's not terrifying constantly.
Right. It's sort of interesting because he asks a team several times throughout the film if he wants to come to mosque with him. You know, your Muslim boy, come to the mosque with me. And Atim keeps refusing him. And at first, it's almost like commanding, like, hey, you better go. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. But by the end, it's almost like begging, you know, when he says, like, Ramadan's coming up, I'm lonely, come with me to mosque. You know, he's talking about how lonely he is.
I don't know much about Islam, honestly. So if I sound ignorant, I don't mean to.
I mean, the Islam varies quite a bit from culture to culture. Like it's not, you know, people have this idea that like it's all uniform, but you know, see by looking at this film culturally how different it is than you know, how Islam might look in Saudi Arabia, for instance, or Iran. Like it's
it very feels more casual.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like I mentioned Timbuktu earlier, like that film really sort of explores that. Like this film, it sort of feels just like you happen to notice it, you know, it's part of the background, it's not really commenting on it in that way. But like Timbuktu, it's about the like jihadist occupation of Timbuktu, and like I think sometimes for Western, you know, people outside of the region listening to the news, it sounds like, oh, it's like Muslims fighting Muslims, it's all like civil strife. But like Timbuktu, I thought it was so great, it really highlighting, you know, it's like one completely different culture or different cultures like invading people with completely different practices. You know, there's like how women should dress, what, you know, what they should sing about, like completely different rules and completely different interpretations of Quran, beliefs, practices. You know, there's a scene in Timbuktu where they're a woman who's like selling fish, and the jihadists say like, well, you have to put gloves on, you know, those are the rules. Like you have to be modest and wear black gloves. And she's like, that's stupid. I sell fish. Like, I'm not going to wear gloves. But, you know, it's that kind of one culture invading another and changing the rules, saying like, no, this is how you have to interpret the religion. It's like, again, like a form of colonialism. I think people don't realize to go on a tangent. But I was reading, just like doing a little bit of like background research about cinema in Chad. There's not that many films that were produced.
There were, forgot the name of the movie offhand, but there was another Chadian director who did a movie with Harun, who they were kind of competing for a while with like making a like movie there a few years, but then he kind of fell off and they did. There's some of that I think he wrote with him.
Okay. So they collaborated on something.
Yeah, and a couple things. Thing was,
Okay.
Bye Bye Africa, they worked together on, and in a purely narrative film, they worked together on.
I'm gonna have to look into it.
I can't find what it's called.
One thing that I thought was like a little bit sad, they said there's one working cinema in all of Chad.
Yeah.
So, like it's you know, I think that's too bad.
That's true.
I
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw this, but I listened to the BBC Africa Today podcast. It's just the BBC news on
Oh, okay.
Africa. It's
Right.
really great. And Haroon from 2007, I think spring 2017 to spring to I think about a month ago, he was the Minister of Culture for the President's cabinet in Chad, or Prime Minister's
Okay.
cabinet. But then he got rid of him because he was a bit too busy making movies.
Right, because he just had a new film that came out, right? I think it
Yeah.
was at TIFF last year. I didn't see it, but
Yeah. I weren't, yeah.
he shot it in France, right?
Yeah,
It's
it's one of his French movies about a Chadian family that moves to France.
okay. I'm gonna have to. I don't think it's had like a wide release yet,
No.
or
Well, where I
like
live,
been
it's,
released to home video.
where I live, it ain't gonna show up.
It's a bummer. And TIFF, there's always too much to catch. I never see as much as I'd like to, but I don't know. Now he's definitely on my radar, so I'm gonna have to dive in.
Oh, the another connection to other African cinema is the song at the end credits is by Wassis Diop, who was the brother of Djibril Diop Mbete.
Oh, who did Hyenas and
Yes.
Tuki Buki? Yeah.
Yeah,
Okay.
his screenwriter brother had a song at the end of this movie.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah,
That's
I didn't know that
really
either.
cool.
Like the narration that comes in, I think like maybe three times, is
Yeah.
very, like usually like with most narration, it's kind of like a monologue essentially, but this narration is literally like maybe three sentences for each part, and I think the last one does this like really like almost David Lynchy like echo effect of him. Of what he's gonna say before he kills Nasara. Yeah.
Or he's about to
And like this the sound design in general is very
it's very
yeah,
deliberate.
yeah. Like it feels like the sound design in and of itself of the world is basically a soundtrack.
I'm trying to. Was there a character in a David Lynch film who used an electrolarynx? I'm trying to remember now if that seems like something that would have been in like Twin Peaks, or I can't remember
Yeah,
now.
I can't think. I don't think so.
But I mean that again, like the sound of it's that electronic voice. Like there's no warmth in it, so it takes you like a little while to kind of see that in him and see that there's another side to him. You know, so that's another area where the sound design makes a difference. Like that's I don't know. I found, you know, that's such an interesting choice. And there's you look at the characters who are a little bit older in the film, there aren't that many people who aren't injured in some way. Like, you know, is the grandfather
Yeah.
blind, you know, just from being older, or is that from an injury? I don't know.
Yeah, that's just left vague, and that's another thing that makes it feel like a folk tale, like the blind old wise man.
Yeah. Who the blind old man who's bent on vengeance.
Yeah.
That old trope.
And then Nasara, he can't speak, and then there's the soldier missing a leg later on.
Yeah. Well, like at the very end, like he's praying, but like you know, it's not coming out because you know his cutthroat. But
Yeah.
like the grandfather can still sort of hear him, so that's
Yeah.
when he's like finish him off, and Nasara sort of figures out that he has to play dead. But you know, but it's like very subtle, the kind of sound. Like again, you know, you sort of mentioned that the deliberate nature of the sound design, the fact that it starts off with a blind person, you know, maybe makes you think in terms of sound as much as the visuals, even though they're quite striking. You sort of maybe
Yeah.
become aware of the audio, like you said, you know, the sounds of the gunshots, and you sort of try to imagine what the grandfather's world is because he's blind. So,
Oh
like
yeah.
right from the get-go, it kind of puts you in that state.
Yeah, and the desert, like the desert and the city and all that, it even though it's very impoverished, it feels like very almost kind of warm in a strange
Yeah.
way. Like
I mean the color goes a long way. Like
yeah.
sometimes when you have the green and orange of the robes or the like I think Aisha, she has that like red umbrella. It just
Yeah.
adds sort of warmth, like you said. It adds, you know, a life to this world. And like the you know, where a team comes from, like it seems like so drab. Like, you know, his grandfather's dressed like in that yellow robe at the beginning, and I think like at the very end, you know, the big climax, like the desert, it's the same color as the sky almost. Like the sky is not blue, it's like, you know, tan bread colored
Yeah.
again. You know, so like the city seems like a much more colorful place. You know, you have, you know, Nasara has like blue robes, or you have the Aisha, she's in orange a lot of the time, or green sometimes, and you know, there's more color in it. You sort of feel like it's a place where you know, a team like it's him in the big city for the first time. Like it's a place where young people kind of grow and experience the
Yeah.
world and are exposed to ideas that maybe challenge what they believe. You know, like in its core, like this is sort of a, to some extent, like a coming of age story about somebody, you know, with this hard past, who has like a very clear idea of what's right and wrong and how the world is, having that challenged by being, you know, sent off into the world. You know, the grandfather says like, "May Allah protect you," and basically gives him a
Yeah.
boot off into the world.
So you're saying it's kind of like a YA story?
I mean, it is a young adult story. I
Yeah,
mean, I wish,
technically.
you know, young adult stories were, you know, better like this. I mean, I'd feel okay showing this movie to teenagers. Like,
Yeah.
that's not, I don't think anything would go over their head, really. Like, you know, this is, like you said, pretty straightforward. It has that quality like a parable. It's not, you know, you can kind of read into the political context, like the background, the history. You know, you said, oh, there's the flag of Chad next to
Yeah.
these thug soldiers, like that's there. But I think, you know, if you just want to come away with like a basic understanding of this movie, you don't really need much context.
Yeah.
I think probably anyone could watch this and take something away from it emotionally, or you know, maybe have their ideas about the world and about compassion and empathy expanded just by watching it.
Yeah, and it's I remember I first saw it on Fandor, which is probably my favorite streaming site, and like the thumbnail they used is a team with a gun, and then it sounds like this like action revenge movie. Then you watch it, and it's like, oh no, it's
Yeah.
a complete twist on the revenge movie where it's a revenge movie about forgiveness and growing
Yeah.
up and learning that the cycle of violence needs to end at some point.
Like, you know, revenge doesn't mean anything if the other person that you're getting revenge on doesn't understand what you felt. Like, that's sort of, you know, like the ultimate revenge is making somebody empathize with you, right? Like,
Yeah.
understand your hurt, your pain. You know, I think in a way that that's like a better revenge than inflicting physical pain on somebody. You
Yeah.
know, to say like I, you know, this deep emotional wound, you know, I'm going to share it with you. Like, I think that's maybe a smarter approach to revenge on film.
Yeah, like
Maybe not always as exciting, but you know.
Yeah, like with this one, like as mentioned earlier, like presumably Nusra stole a team's gun, and I
Yeah.
think after that scene is when he asks where he's from, and a team says, "Oh, I'm from the Wade region,"
Yeah.
which at first I was like, "Oh, Wade," and that was a minor African kingdom that there's not much information about, but I was like, "Oh, some African history here," but then he's like. Then he says, but by your scarification, I think you're from this one village.
Right.
And then immediately it seems,
He has some idea, yeah.
yeah. So I think at that point he knows, oh, okay, he realizes this guy is here to kill me. I don't know when or if it's going to happen.
But he also has these like pretty big gestures of trust, like you know that scene where he's looking at his scar in the mirror, and I think he asks that team to get his like back harness, and the closet's full of guns.
It's like 10 or 11 guns in there,
He tells that team, he's like, "Oh, you should take one."
and
He's like, "Yeah, a young man should have a gun." You know, a team doesn't really know like if he took his gun or not, but just that gesture that, okay, I trust you enough, like you can have one. It's just, I don't want you to kill me. It seems to be the sort of implication of that.
like Nosferatu's trying to reform his life, and I
Yeah.
got the impression he wasn't religious when he was younger at all, and he became religious after the Civil War.
Yeah.
And
That seems to be the case. Yeah.
but like he still holds on to the guns as like a symbol, like he can't quite move on from the old person that he used to be. I feel like the guns are definitely a symbol of his former self, the war criminal self.
Yeah.
Like I don't know about you, but both times I come away feeling more sympathetic towards the war criminal than the victim of the war criminal. Even though he did horrible things, like I like that this movie makes a point to humanize him and show that, like he's a person. He regrets things he did. He wants to change his ways. And like, I think maybe it's just because a teen might be a teenager. I sympathize more with the person who's not a teenager.
I feel for a team, but like he's somebody who's, you know, still kind of not confused, but like he's still trying to figure himself out, and he's trying to figure out how the world works, you know. So like I maybe empathize with him more on that level than just as like a passive victim, you know. Like I think he's trying to figure out how does he fit into all of this. You know, am I going to be the person who gets revenge, and am I going to be like these soldiers, or, you know,
Or his
or am I
grandfather.
going to be a baker? You know, what does life have in store for me? So
And I kind of assume his father was in the military because he has an army jacket.
well, like, I mean, that was his father's gun, so
Yes,
you know,
so
he
probably. So his father
probably.
may have done terrible things too, but that's never really.
No, you know, and again, like I sort of wondered, could it have been a team's father that gave Nasaha that scar? Like, you know, I don't think necessarily that a team's father would have been so innocent. You know, it's a civil war; people do horrible things to each other. You know, like Nasara says, like I've done like bad things, but the question then becomes, how do you move past that? How do you, you know, is forgiveness even an option, or is that letting people who did horrible things off the hook, you know?
Like, even though it's specific to Chad, it definitely is a very universal story that you could tell with like Syria, or like this type of story could go anywhere. Like there could be like an American Civil War version of it.
Sure, it seems like Mohammad Saleh Haroun wanted to make something a little bit more universal, something, you know, like you said, the parable. It's something that maybe anybody can learn from or take something away from.
And this is my final thing. My favorite moment in the whole movie is when the police show up when they're baking bread, and there's this tiny moment of you learn Nosferatu is illiterate, and he gives the piece of paper to a team to read it to him, and he trusts him enough to not lie to him about what's on the police report.
Right. The other bread company informed on him, reported on him,
Yeah.
you know, which again tells you something about like how that country is operating at that point in time. But I'll tell you my favorite moment since we're on it. But it's when they're making the bread and the power goes out. And he's like, "Allah damn the electrical company." But so yeah, thank you for bringing it to my
No,
attention
you're
and pitching
welcome.
this episode. I was really excited to delve in, and I'm hopefully going to go further in and find Mohammad Saleh Haroun's other films and check that out.
I think this Durant is on Amazon Prime. A Screaming Man is on Amazon Prime, and things say Greek Grease is on Amazon Prime.
Okay, I'm probably going to check out A Screaming Man next, since That's the one that comes right after,
Yeah.
and like just from what you're describing, makes me curious to see it.
It's definitely and more melancholic and not as ambiguous, although it's definitely similar. And Grease is, I don't like it as much. It definitely is flawed, but it still is interesting.
Okay. I'll check it out. Anyway, so if folks want to find you on the internet, where can they look?
They can go to at High and Low Pod on Twitter. That's the Twitter account for my podcast, High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast, where myself and Joel from Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space, but we take a Kurosawa movie and pair it with another Japanese movie from the same year. So it's just an excuse for us to go through like old movies and use Filmstruck, and it, basically we just wanted a great excuse to be like to watch every Kurosawa movie, and that's basically
That's a good reason
yeah.
to.
Can I bring up one more thing?
Oh, absolutely.
I have a movie blog called well, everyone has a movie blog, but mine is called Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema, where I go
Oh,
through
it's like the prisoner, Scorpion 701, right?
And right now I am at the tail end of the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, which has taken me kind of a long time because I'm not a film
Those
expert
are
in it.
pretty dense movies.
Yeah, and it's just so dense. It's like, what am I going to write about? But
I just saw like there's the new Battles Without Honor and Humanities.
I
There's
might.
like the sequel series. Like
Yeah, I'm not going to
it's
do
endless.
those for a while.
Right.
But yeah, so I'm going to close up the battle series, and next up after that is Belladonna Sadness, this kind of, I guess,
Okay.
erotic anime.
It's like early hentai film,
Kind of.
kind of. It's weird. It's
Yeah, it has one of my favorite actors, Tatsuya Nakadai, as the devil.
oh, I didn't realize.
Oh yeah, and
Oh,
he's in this
he's an amazing actor. He's one of the greatest
actors, period.
ever.
Yeah.
It's also like it's an animated film where I feel like 70% of it is like still shots.
Yeah,
So you're
it's
watching it like glorious HD and it's like a still image for a good chunk.
Yeah, and it's like set in medieval Europe.
It's unusual.
It's really something, but yeah, I highly recommend tracking it down.
If you ever need a break though from Japanese cinema, like you're not obligated. You can come on here and talk about anything.
Okay, yeah, there are some other things I really want to talk about.
Okay. But thank you once again, and
Now you're
until next
welcome.
time, listeners, take care. Bye.